My dad used to, you'll learn the significance. My dad used to use taking his jacket off in the middle of a sermon as a theatrical ploy. so he'd be disappointed that I'm doing it already. First of all, thank you very much for coming out this evening. And from my point of view, thank you so much for actually staying and hearing what I have to say. What I have to say, and I've tried to attend all of the talks so far. We were unable to attend last week, but I see that you're recording them. I wondered how they're getting up there. So, and it's been really interesting. What I have to share with you is a very personal story, and I'm sharing it, I guess, for two reasons. One is in the hopes that some of you who maybe have faith or have had faith for a long time might relate and to some of the things I'm saying, and some of the thoughts that I have might resonate for you, might help you. And also, for those of you who are maybe wondering about faith, I would hope that's something that I have to say gives you an insight into this world of faith, and perhaps, dare I say, might debunk a couple of the stereotypical images that you might have. I want to begin by asking you to imagine that you're in a room. But this room is all you've known. You've only ever been in this room. The room has lots of other people in it. And they seem to be happy people. And they're friendly. And they're good people. Your family's in this room too. And as were your grandparents, and possibly your great-grandparents. The room has windows, and you can see out of the room to a world you've never been. People outside the room seem to be happy, enjoying life, but you're told this is an illusion. They're actually desperately unhappy and unfulfilled. In fact, life outside the room is very dark and depressing. Worse than that, it's dangerous to be outside the room. You learn that there are two types of people. There are people who are in the room and people on the outside. Sometimes, someone from the outside comes into your room. And they confirm everything you've been told about the outside. Sometimes, not often, people leave the room. Nobody really talks about it. You don't know why. They don't come back. People pretend it hasn't happened. Because to leave the room is a shameful thing. In fact, so shameful that people in the room look at the remaining relatives and family with a degree of suspicion and mistrust. So, my name's Stephen Morgan, Marta Maureen. We've got two adult daughters, Victoria and Emily. And Maureen and I became members of SBC about 18 years ago when we moved to the area. We were searching for somewhere to worship. And we crossed a lot of thresholds, which was a fascinating experience for someone who had, for the previous part of his life, always been encouraging other people to do that very same thing and never had to do it. And it's interesting how tough it is. But we were looking for somewhere to worship, somewhere we could feel at home. And Linda Harrison is my cousin. And we invited David and Linda over for a meal, and Linda said, "Have you tried my church?" And we said, "No, what's your church?" "Sterling Baptist Church." "Well, we live in Falkirk. We haven't got as far as Sterling in our ever-increasing circles." And so we came along on a Sunday night, a 6:30 Sunday night, and 18 years ago, 6:30 Sunday night when we arrived was in the main sanctuary, and the sanctuary was pretty much full. It was a full-on rock gospel worship service. I don't know if any of you remember that fantastic guitarist Steve, who used to play, I used to sit and watch Steve just with a sense of awe and wonder, thinking, I would pay to see you. And of course, we've got some great musicians, but for me, this was a real, as you will learn, contrast, dramatic contrast. And in fact, that Sunday night, I stood there hearing some familiar songs sung in a totally different way, some very new songs, and I stood there thinking, this is very different. Am I uncomfortable because I think there's something wrong with this? Or is it just that I'm unfamiliar with this kind of worship environment? And I decided it was the latter, and we kind of fell in love with it. On our way out, Alistair was on the door, and he shook our hands and welcomed us as guests and visitors to the worship service. And one of the things I remember, we remember that, we've reminded him occasionally that, he told us, he said, it's not always this noisy. we became members of SBC. Maureen recently stepped down as a deacon and a church secretary, having served 6 years in that role for SBC. I'm currently chair of deacons and chair of church meetings. Together about 8 years ago, we set up and we facilitate, I would say, coordinate the Falkirk and Larbert home group, which I've been say for about 8 years. Professionally, Maureen's background is in learning and development. She's focused on leadership development. I, on the other hand, in terms of my professional career, I studied mechanical engineering and materials science and left to go into a commercial research establishment. I and another guy who joined at the same time had ideas, and the notion was we would submit our research towards our doctorates. And however, when the research establishment wouldn't allow me to publish any of my research on the basis, for peer review, on the basis that it was commercially sensitive, the writing was on the wall. And after about 5 years, I got very frustrated and felt trapped. And I left to become a teacher of maths and computing in a secondary school. After about 2 years, I had a department. And then in 1987, I joined the TSB Bank, the original one, the real TSB Bank. No one else out there at the moment, but the real TSB Bank with its heritage in social impact. And I joined TSB Bank as an analyst programmer. And for the next 30 years, my career was in financial services and IT, and that's where I stayed, latterly holding senior and executive roles in Bank of Ireland, HBOS, and most recently Lloyds Banking Group. About 3 years ago, I decided I wanted to retire so that I could focus more on my voluntary and church activities. So in addition to my church responsibilities, I'm on the board of Blythewood Trust, with Gordon Stewart, who spoke a few weeks ago. I'm on the board of Stone Credit Union, where I'm leading an IT transformation. Look out, about a month, going to have some brand spanking new IT stuff, which is going to be good for everybody and good for the credit union. And the other thing, Maureen and I recently trained as debt coaches for CAP. So we've been out visiting people, and that's been fundamentally, it's been wonderful and eye-opening and a privilege. So that's me. That's us. In terms of my family background, I was born into a loving Christian home to Frank and Isabel Worgan. I became a Christian at the age of 12, preached my first sermon at the age of 15, and at the age of 18, went to university in America to join a preacher training program, as it was called in the States. And that was the age of 18. I want to paint a picture of this environment into which I was born, because it's relevant to what I want to share with you this evening. My dad, Frank Worgan, these are photographs from the 1960s and 1970s. He he's 97 now, still sharp as a tack. He was what you would call here a pastor. In our church, he was called a preacher or an evangelist. He was a popular, effective a preacher in lots of demand. He was regularly invited to preach what we called gospel missions, where he would preach from Sunday to Sunday, every evening, and in some places in America, he'd preach at an 8 a.m. breakfast service, and there'd be two services in the evening, and we would go on preaching tours of the U.S., and there were times when I thought, actually, if something happened to my dad, I could get up right now and finish the sermon that he'd started. He preached throughout the U.K., Europe, and Scandinavia, predominantly, and the USA. And that's significant to my story. In addition to planting churches, that's what he did, and life for us was very church-centric. A couple of years ago, Dad visited our home group in Falkirk, and that for him, as you'll learn, was a massive step. Visited our home group, and after the visit to the home group, David Wright, who's a member of this church, commented, he said, he knows how to use his voice. And he was a brilliant orator. He still uses that voice now when he still preaches at 97. I don't understand. He keeps on saying he's going to retire. My mum used to joke that if my dad hadn't been a preacher, he would have been a fine Shakespearean actor. Well, family life was, it was a good family life. It was stable and loving, a Christian home. Life was entirely church-centric. At times, Sundays involved at least three services, three visits to church, Sunday morning worship, home for lunch, Sunday school in the afternoon, and a gospel outreach service in the evening. And if Dad was helping to plant a nearby church, he'd be squeezing in another gospel service somewhere in between that as well. So sometimes it's four times on a Sunday. Books surrounded me from an early age. My dad read a lot. And one of the things that I guess, learned from him was to value, treasure, and respect the privilege of being able to speak to people and not to take that for granted. Even though he was preparing the same, about to prepare and preach a sermon that he preached before, he would spend time studying and in preparation. As I say, books surrounded me, and I was encouraged to read those books and study. I learned the love of learning from my dad. I saw him do it. Thirdly, we had lots of visitors. Because my dad was well known in Europe and America, people were always making detours to come and stop by us, and we'd have them for lunch or they'd stay over. And for a young person, a young kid growing up, that was a fantastic thing because it really broadened my horizons from an early age. I was exposed to people from all kinds of different cultures, from India, from Africa, from America, and it was just a wonderful experience. Now, because of some of what I want to share with you, I'm not going to tell you which church group I was born into. I want to be very respectful to the people who are in that church group and to what they believe, but it's important in relation to my personal journey. It was a branch of the Restoration Movement emerging in the US and the UK in the early to mid-1800s. And the Restoration Movement had the laudable aim of addressing the increasing disunity and factionalism in Christianity by saying, let's go back to New Testament, the New Testament church. Let's forget all of the things that we've built on top of the simple Christian message and return to the simplicity, the practices and beliefs of the New Testament church. That's what the Restoration Movement was about. The church was and is evangelistic in nature and Bible-centered. And the significance of that was that the church rejected all manner and any kind of creed and tradition. So you refer to the creed, the church would reject that entirely because it's not in the Bible. The church wasn't a small or obscure group. Currently, I looked this up, there are about 2 to 3 million members in the USA. In the UK, the church used to be influential until the mid-1920s. It was one of the larger movements in the UK. when the church split, and then the larger body that split off, and talk about it in a second, joined the United Reformed Church, and its name was lost in the UK. An oft-quoted maxim expressed by members of the church was this one: where the Bible speaks, we speak. Where the Bible is silent, we are silent. Which is a great, great maxim. Internally, however, the roots of that church movement in the Restoration movement of the early 1800s wasn't acknowledged. I grew up believing and understanding that all other churches were man-made and we were in the true church. And we were in the church that Jesus built. From an early age, I guess an early teen, I began to struggle with some of these ideas. And I wanted to challenge and understand how it came to be that we believe these things. Because ironically, although the call was to the simplicity and the freedom and the liberty of New Testament Christianity, actually, there was an edifice of doctrines and beliefs that one was expected to accept and adhere to. I wanted to challenge things. I struggled with this. I struggled with the attitude towards scholarship, for example. Although my dad studied under F.F. Bruce at Manchester University and throughout his career corresponded with various scholars, including Beazley Murray, a well-known Baptist scholar, within the church there was a deep mistrust of academia. Again, example, when it became known that I was going to go to university to study engineering, a non-Christian university to study engineering, material science, an elder of the church took me aside and warned me that if I went to university, I risked losing my faith. For Maureen, it was worse. Not only was she going to university, she was also going to university to study theology. And worse still, she's a woman. What did a woman need a degree for? Surely her ambition should be to be a good homemaker. And that brings me to the other thing that I struggled with, which was the attitude towards women. Women had little to no impact or influence on church life. Women didn't participate in the decisions of the church. In worship, women weren't allowed. If men were present, women weren't allowed to speak or pray aloud or engage in Bible discussion in our Bible studies. If men were present. I'll give an example. Our church used to hold a lectureship every year, which was a 2 to 3 day event when men from around the country and overseas would be invited to give lectures. And it was a lectureship more than a series of worships. We had worship in the evening. And they were very good events. And for a number of years, I was responsible for recording the talks and lectures in the main auditorium. So we had a recording studio at the back, and I used to sit with my headphones on and record the tapes, and we had speed duplicators and all kind of stuff, so all high tech in those days. For 1 hour every day, the lectureship, the main auditorium was given over to the ladies of the church, whilst the men attended seminars in some of the other rooms of the church building. Well, I had to set the recording equipment going and then remove my headphones and walk out of the recording studio before any of the women spoke. I wanted to understand whether our literal and uncritical reading of passages such as 1 Corinthians 14, women should remain silent, silent in the churches, was the only rendering of that passage, or was the meaning that Paul meant. I wanted to discuss this, but it was a resolved issue. Other doctrines were fixed and inflexible. I struggled with the doctrine of the verbal inspiration of the Bible. Verbal inspiration means that every word in the Greek text or the Hebrew text is dictated by God through human authors. The human authors had no influence on the choice of words. God chose the words. One of the consequences of this is that there is no scope for things such as the synoptic problem. There isn't a synoptic problem because nobody copied one another. It was dictated by God. There's no room for theological ideas such as redaction criticism, where one looks at the role of the author as an editor in selecting material in order to convey a message. There's no scope for other forms of textual criticism because God chose the words. That's what verbal inspiration means. In actual fact, in the 1920s, the split in the UK that I refer to came about because the preachers who were emerging from the church's college, which was based in Overdale in Birmingham, started to emerge in the 1920s with these so-called liberal ideas, which many of which had emerged from German theological schools. I struggled with the insistence on a literal reading of Genesis 1 to 3, 7-day creation. I don't object if somebody wants to believe that, and for many years I did, and I argued for it. I just simply wanted the liberty to debate it and see if there were alternatives. I was concerned about, for example, I referred to our experience coming here for worship, the rejection of instrumental music in worship. So singing was a cappella. Now, when you've got a lot of people together and there are no instruments and people are singing parts, which is what we did, it sounds fantastic. But was that really such an important deciding point in terms of dogma? It wasn't that I wanted to reject all of these things. I simply wanted to be able to question them and ask why. And is that the only answer? And if somebody comes to a conclusion of something different, was it really necessary to see them leave the church? In fact, I struggled with attitudes towards other Christians in other churches. I've already talked about the notion that we were the one true church. The view was very much that other Christians, well, there weren't any other Christians. The only Christians were in the church. And even to this day, when we occasionally bump into people or we hear, come across some reading, people say, there's no church in so-and-so. I actually heard somebody say once, there's no church in Manchester. But really? I live in Manchester. These are not unusual views. But you can recognize them from Texas, yeah. So instead of a willingness to debate and explore together and to re-explore, the expectation was to conform to a set of views that had been handed down. Another saying that you often find in some of the church literature and sometimes on the walls of the church buildings is this one: in matters of faith, unity; in matters of opinion, liberty; in all things, love. So that's saying, of course, that there ought to, in order for there to be fellowship between us as Christians, we ought to agree on some essential things that we might call matters of faith. Matters of faith are the things that are deal breakers, if you like. That's the idea. But then there are other things that are matters of opinion. We don't have to agree on those. That was the notion. And I used to say to my dad, so how do we decide what's a matter of faith and what's a matter of opinion? Who decides? What if I decide something is a matter of opinion? It's not all that important. But the person next to me says it's a matter of faith. What then? I began to feel that unity was more about uniformity and that liberty was in increasingly short supply. I said at the age of 18, I went off to preacher training school in the States. And although I had a full scholarship to continue that, which would have been a certain route into ministry, after 1 year I decided to return to the UK and study mechanical engineering and materials science at Aston University. Living away from home at university, influences converged to really challenge me. I borrowed theology books from Maureen. I was at Aston, Maureen was at Birmingham. We met at church on Sundays. I've been told not to say any more about that. safe. Next year we'll be married 40 years. So I borrowed books from Maureen, and I was fascinated by these, what she was being exposed to, and I bought a book on modern theological thought by the theologian Rudolf Bultmann. Kind of weird, I guess, an engineering student reading that kind of stuff, but that's what I did. Because I wanted to explore, and I was being challenged. He described a type of Christian, a form of Christianity, which he said claimed to be Bible-centered, take the Bible as its guide and only the Bible as its guide, and to reject all human creeds and writings and dogma. However, he said, although there is no written creed, the creed is actually passed down orally from generation to generation. And this movement will also establish its own theological seminaries in order to pass on the accepted views. And he called this party line theology. So that was a brilliant party line theology. And as a young 20-year-old student sitting in his digs reading that, I thought, that's us. He's describing us. We do that. So I began to really question my church and to see it through different lenses. The second thing, the influence, was while I was studying science and engineering and a melting pot of a university. And it wasn't that science was challenging my faith, but what it did was challenged me to think differently about faith. I remember, for example, being in a physics lecture, and the lecturer was talking about something called universal constants. And these are things that are, as far as we are aware, unchanging throughout the universe. The speed of light in a vacuum, Planck's constant, Coulomb's constant, and there's about 20 of them, right? And he said, we have a problem. And I remember from this big lecture theatre, he says, imagine a row of dials, a dial for each constant, and each constant is set. He said, if we touch just one of those dials and change it, he said, the universe ceases to exist. So he said, the problem we have is, how were they all set correctly at the Big Bang? I sat there and thinking, oh. Now, since then, there have been all kinds of other thoughts in physics about parallel universes, and I've heard one scientist talk about universes, big bangs, a cascading universes, an infinite number of universes. The point is, the probability of that, those dials being set at the Big Bang, is so infinitely large as to be scientifically impossible. So how do we deal with that? So science didn't challenge my faith. It made me think differently. But I began to think about my faith and think, well, did I believe? Was I the product of social conditioning? Had I become a Christian because it was expected of me, Frank Morgan's son, and I was seeking approval? If I did believe, what did I believe? What was it? Outwardly, I continued to attend church, but inwardly I wrestled with my faith. And what did I do? Well, I turned to books. And these are some of them I've still got in my library. I turned to Christian apologetics, the arguments for belief in Christianity and in faith, and belief in God. I also read people who weren't approved by my church to see what they had to say. I read what Jewish scholars had to say. I read psychology I wanted to understand how our environment and how the things around us can influence our perception and thinking. Because I wanted to know if I recognized that in myself. I engaged in philosophy. I started with Philosophy Made Simple to find a way through it, and then found myself to Bertrand Russell, the atheist, who dealt with the idea of the supernatural, and then to David Hume, who talked about the problem of truth and can we ever know truth. I enrolled in a philosophy course taught by a lecturer at from Maureen's the theology department of Birmingham. I would say, yes, there was a fourth reason why Maureen going to university was an issue, because one of her professors was John Hick. Anybody know who John Hick was, what he published? That recognize anybody? No, right? It became national news at the time. He published a book called The Myth of God Incarnate. So he was a leading theologian at the time, questioning the very essence of Christianity, the notion of God incarnate. This guy was from Birmingham University, teaching philosophy. And after, we struck up a friendship, and we would meet after class for coffee and have a bit of a discussion. We discussed the idea of God. He was an atheist, I wasn't. We discussed the idea of life after death. He didn't believe in it, I did. We discussed the idea of the supernatural. He didn't think there was a supernatural, I did. He thought all truth was relative, I didn't. He told me he was a Buddhist. And then he told me that he was applying for a post in the Church of England because he loved the ritual. I said to him, how could you be a priest in the Church of England when you don't believe any of it? And his answer, seriously to me, was, he said, the congregation doesn't need to know that. In the end, through this, I guess, process of doubt and questioning, living away from home, I stripped my faith down to its essential, stripped away that edifice of doctrine and dogma. And I concluded, and it's probably pretty obvious to you, that the only thing that matters is this. Did Jesus rise from the dead? If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then everything else is irrelevant. There is no God. We are probably in an empty, hostile universe. And none of the other doctrines of the church matter. If Jesus did rise from the dead, that changes everything. It means there is a God. It means that everything that Jesus said was true about sin, about a loving God who wants to be close to us. I came to my own conclusions about the other stuff, about the role of the Creator in creation, about the inspiration and authority of the Bible and so forth, the role of women in church. I came to my own conclusion. And I emerged from that process with a faith that was different to my dad's. But it was my faith. It was my faith. Did I leave the church? That room into which I'd been born? No, I didn't. And why not? Well, three reasons. First was for the sake of my parents. Because I knew, and Maureen knew, that if we left the church, Maureen was a member of the church too, we left the church, it would have a devastating impact on my parents and our relationship with them, potentially. More than that, I knew it would have a devastating impact on my father's reputation. And he was still an active preacher. And I respected my father. And I didn't want to do that. Secondly, I was kind of in my mid-20s by then. And I knew I wasn't alone in my generation wanting to challenge these things. And maybe it was the ambition and the ego of mid-20s guys, but I thought I could change things. We thought we could change things from the inside. That's what we wanted to do. And thirdly, the reason why we didn't leave immediately was it was just plain difficult. There was a lot at stake. Because I knew that to leave that room, that church, would mean that for the people with whom I'd grown up, we would be viewed as worse than unbelievers. People would cut us off, and people we'd grown up with and known for many years would no longer be going to their homes for meals. And that's what happened. That's what happened. It took another 20 years before we left. Periodically, we'd come across points in our lives where we think, this feels like the right time. And something would happen, usually to do with family. We're thinking, it's just not the right time. Eventually, we left. And we came here 18 years ago. My parents really struggled with it. I remember I can't say what I'm going to tell you. Something that my dad said to me. But he got over it. And he's visited here. He's heard me preach here. And for him, that's an enormous step. As I said, coming to our house group was an enormous thing for him to do. And people that we've known avoid us, and we do if we sometimes meet them, and occasionally, you know, we'll go to the funeral of somebody that we've known, and the other people who we grew up with generally are polite, but you can see that they're very uncomfortable that we've turned up at all. Churches who used to invite me to preach stopped calling. Because I wasn't in the church anymore. So, where has grace touched my life? I would say grace has touched my life in every part throughout my life. In my case, I've had to balance finding expression of my own personal faith with the impact it will have on people around me. People I love. A few years ago, a number of us from this church went to Lithuania to work with an emerging church, and they were converting an old Soviet hotel, which actually didn't have a square angle in the place. Roddy Evans and I spent the whole week laying perfectly square tiles on the floor and the walls, and nothing was square. We converting it into a Christian centre. And one evening, we had the evening off, and we were walking along the shores of the Baltic Sea, and I was walking with Solus, the pastor. And he told me his conversion story. He'd grown up in the Soviet era, and what a story. And it involved life and death stuff. It really did. It was dramatic. And it meant that he flicked from unbelief to belief. And then he said to me, so what about you? And I said, well, I was born into a Christian family and became a Christian at the age of 12. I struggled a bit in my 20s and then made my faith my own. And he looked at me and said, is that it? And I'm really proud of my response. We walked on a little bit further, and I said, he said, is that it? He said, no conversion experience. Those were his words, no conversion experience. We walked on a bit further, and I said, Solus, my whole life has been a conversion experience. I don't believe that faith is about having dramatic experiences. This isn't given to everyone. Some of us have experiences like this. We start with no faith, something happens in our lives, and we emerge from that process with faith. Or maybe you're above the line. So this graph, you can see faith, no faith. Maybe you start above the line, and you've got a faith. Then something happens, and your faith is boosted to a new level. That something could be all manner of things. It could be anything from a bereavement to a happy event to an illness or something that you just can't explain. My experience wasn't that. My experience was closer to that. I describe that as a squiggle, right? There are periods of chaos and turmoil when things happen, and then you start working things out. And to be honest, and let's be honest with each other, although most of us would love that and have a continuum, I reckon that most of us really, that's our faith experience. We have areas of certainty and calm between areas of our life of challenge and uncertainty and doubt. I actually think that's healthy and that's good. I think doubt is good. Doubt causes you to question. Doubt causes you to reevaluate and to emerge more certain of what you thought when you began. So has God been active in my life? Of course he has. He's God. What a question. But I actually don't feel that I need to be able to point out where. I'm just content to know that he's there and that he's behind everything, and I can give him the thanks and the praise for everything that I have and I am. You know, think about the Ethiopian eunuch. From the perspective of the reader, we read that passage in Acts of the Ethiopian who's traveling from Jerusalem back down to Ethiopia. And we know God's in it. We know it's a God thing that he sends Philip to meet him. But put yourself in the shoes of the Ethiopian. He's in his chariot, tootling along on this long journey, reading aloud from the scriptures, as was the custom of the day. It was the only way you could make sense of the text by reading aloud. A guy along the way says, "You understand what you're reading?" He said, "How can I? I need something to show me." "Well, I'll show you." And Philip joins him, he picks up a hitchhiker. And the hitchhiker explains to him what he's reading, and then tells him about Jesus. And the Ethiopian says, "I want to be his follower." And he becomes a follower of Jesus. Next thing he knows, the hitchhiker's gone somewhere. He's carried on his own journey. There's nothing miraculous in that, is there? I just want to leave you with a few observations then and reflections based on this experience. The first is, and I don't know why one isn't coming up. I'll tell you what it is. Oh, there you go. The first is, do I challenge you? I plead with you. Own your faith. Make your faith your own. Do whatever it takes for you to be sure about your faith from wherever you're starting. Don't do what you do to please other people or because it's expected of you, because therein lies frustration and emptiness. Now, my approach wouldn't suit you. All that reading and stuff wouldn't suit everybody. But for goodness sake, I was reading science, data-driven, and mathematics. I was working in the world where decisions are made based on data. I wanted information. You might find another path. Do whatever you need to do to make sure you understand your own faith. Faith isn't always a straight line. Sometimes it's a squiggle. Demand of the people around you the permission to explore. And give that permission to other people. Allow people around you to explore non-judgmentally. Just because you are certain about something doesn't somehow transfer to the next person through a process of osmosis. They have to discover their own truth, the truth for themselves. Allow them to explore. Be gracious in allowing people that freedom and be accepting. And accept that neither you nor I are going to have all the answers to all the questions. I would not claim to have all the answers to all the questions. I still struggle with some questions. But whenever I do, I return to that immovable touch point. Whenever I struggle, I remove to that immovable touch point at the center of my faith, which is, what do I believe about Jesus? That's the thing that matters. And finally, just be grateful. Be grateful for all of the experiences that make you you and make you unique. You don't know how God's going to use that. You don't know how you're going to touch the lives of the people around you. I will always be grateful for being born into a Christian home, a loving Christian home. I will always be grateful for the reverence and the respect for Bible knowledge and the learning. I'll always be grateful for the fact that I was shown that learning and studying was the way forward, was the door to the future. I'll always be grateful for the faith and the values that my parents passed on to me, and for the optimism in life to know that whatever happens, God is always in control. So I say to you this evening, hopefully a little bit of a window into a little bit of my journey will resonate with you. And I think what we need to be with one another is honest. It's not always easy. And there are things that happen in your life that cause you to question your faith. And we need to be there to support one another and give each other the liberty and the space to find our faith again. For reasons that are pretty obvious to you, I guess, I always have a soft spot for the Bereans in Acts chapter 17. As a teenager, I used to say to the elders of the church, well, how come I can't do this? I want to challenge and see whether what you're telling me is right. And we need to follow their example.